Welcome to Camp Podcast Special Edition. I am pianist Migo, and I serve as president of the Contemporary Art Music Project, or CAMP. CAMP is an organization that promotes innovative art music and collaborates with composers and performing artists. One of many activities we do is our podcast series. Our hosts explore a wide range of topics from marginalized composers in the music history to current collaborations. CAMP is currently accepting acoustic works, electroacoustic works, and installation proposals for the annual festival Campground 23. Do you want your works to be performed by the CAMP performing artists, to be choreographed by Tampa City Ballet, and to be displayed at Tampa-based gallery Tampa's Projects? Submit your work now. Go to www.contemporaryartmusicproject.org and learn more about Campground 23. Tonight, I am your host, and I am thrilled to talk with composer Dorothy Hindman, who won the commissioning competition for Campground 22. New York Classical Review have called her music bright with energy and belting lyricism, dramatic, highly strung by fanfare, varied, utterly rich with purpose and heart, Huffington Post, powerful and skillfully conceived, the Miami Herald, and music of terrific romantic gesture by the Buffalo News. Dorothy Hindman teaches at the University of Miami as Associate Professor of Composition. We're really honored to have you here. Hi, Dorothy, welcome, and thank you for being here with me.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm really honored and humbled to be here. It's really, I never expected when I sent my piece last year to Campground 22, which is amazing, by the way. I encourage everyone to enter this because it's one of the best conferences I have ever been to. But I was really, really humbled to be invited back again to write for the Campground musicians, who are exceptional and so inspiring.
Thank you so much. And I'm excited to get to know about you through this episode. And we usually start with an icebreaker question about, you know, your background and your early music education, and, you know, how you became a composer. So if you can share this with us, that will be great.
Sure. I'll try to keep it brief. It's complicated, I guess, for anybody who gets into new music, right? But when I was very young, my father was the manager of the local classical station, radio station. Oh. And my mother was a trained pianist, like a brilliant pianist. So my whole early life, I was exposed to classical music, but I didn't have any lessons until college. So when I discovered rock music, like in elementary school, I really fell in love with, you know, the Beatles. And I found in my father's collection, because he would get all kinds of records for the station, I found the Moog album. Oh. And and I listened to this thing and I was like, that's it. That's my instrument. I want to play the synthesizer. Wow. And so, yeah, so I, you know, played in these rock bands and I saved up money and bought synthesizers. And I was going to the community college here because I was putting myself through school. And that's where I had my first lessons on piano. Luckily, they didn't kick me out. But they hired this graduate student from University of Miami to come over and give me analog synthesizer lessons. And he said, go listen to the recordings from the Columbia Princeton labs. Mm-hmm. So I did this. And wow. Again, I was like blown away, like, what is this? But in that whole sort of experience, he said, you should really go and study composition at University of Miami. So I transferred over there. Without that experience at the community college to bring my interests together, I probably would never have discovered new music. But as soon as I discovered it, I was like, what? This is for me. This is it. Yeah. And so that's, in a nutshell, like how I got into new music. Pretty much as soon as I found out you could still be a composer and write for orchestra, I thought you had to be like a film music composer. I didn't think that classical composers were still alive. You know, like, it's crazy. You know, so I'm really fortunate that these things came together and I was able to discover them and then continue, and that nobody sort of stood in my way and said, no. You know, so anyway, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it also tells me how important teachers are and what kind of influence they have on students. It's amazing, really.
Absolutely. And so, like, I will never tell a student you shouldn't be in music. Mm. Because my story is, and I was fragile, you know, I was insecure about my abilities, and because I didn't have the training. And so I feel like, first of all, music, there's no expiration date, right? You could be 18, but by the time you're 30, who knows what you're going to be like. So I always encourage people, you know, follow your passion.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way to go. Yeah. I mean, you just talked about this, you know, influence of funk and rock and it's still in your music, and the timber, sounds, colors that were so important to your work. So, yeah. Would you tell us about that? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when I was studying, like I say, my background is kind of split between classical, like really beautiful classical music. And then after I discovered the Beatles, I discovered Led Zeppelin and punk rock. You know, like this was in the early 80s. And I gravitated not toward the like Duran Duran, but toward the Ramones and the Sex Pistols. And so always toward this almost noisy kind mm-hmm. of music, right? And toward, you know, Led Zeppelin was my big thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, Jimmy Page does all of those experiments with sound, with theremin and, mm-hmm. and the massive mm-hmm. reverb and distortion and things. So, but it wasn't really until I finished my doctorate that I feel like I found a way to bring those two things together. And it was in this piece for cello, amplified cello. So I have this wonderful cellist friend, Craig Holgren, and he had just gotten a Fender tube amp, right? Which is a typical rock, dirty kind of sound. And he wanted a piece for it. And so because it was amplified, I could do all of these different things in terms of color. So Drowning by Numbers is this piece, and I wrote it in 94. So it's super old, but it is my first piece where I planned out the form of the piece by timbre. So the beginning of the piece is like super distorted bowed sounds and very sort of rock and roll. And then the middle of the piece is these percussive sounds and like picked with a guitar pick versus picked with the fingers versus like struck with a percussion mallet. So all of these different sounds that you probably couldn't hear without the amplifier. Mm-hmm. And then the end is really, really quiet sounds, like just brushing the strings with the hand or harmonics and glisses. And so, yeah, really sort of taking advantage of that amplification. But the piece itself also, the other formal thing is that it starts with, it's the pulse is the same. The metronome marking is the same, but at first, the 16th note is the division, and then the 8th note, and then the quarter note. Mm-hmm. So the piece gets slower. And the overall idea is that I had been going to things like June and Buffalo, and hearing this music where it would go long, and then you'd hear mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. This kind of crazy moment. And mm-hmm. I would sort of snap out of whatever it was thinking and go, wow, you know, and then it would just stop. And I felt like, wow, you know, they never really follow up on these aggressive gestures. So I'm going to start this piece with this I don't know, 7 or 8 note, really aggressive gesture, and never leave it. So this whole piece is just this really aggressive gesture and how it sort of dissipates. Because, and then the greater sort of message is, you know, what's the point of aggression in music, right? And so, yeah, it doesn't really, it's kind of empty. So that's how it is by the end. So this is Drowning by Numbers with Craig Hallgren playing it.
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Wow. Well, I have to say wow. And also it's reminds me of one of this untitled piece that was performed at Campground 22. And you have this, I felt like, relationship with the percussion instruments.
Right, yeah. So after I wrote Drowning by Numbers, I wrote that when I was actually studying with Andreessen, Louis Andreessen. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a lot of music that was influenced sort of by Andreessen and by my own sort of looking into symmetrical harmonies. And when it came to electronic music, it was sort of separate for me from chamber music. So I had these two loves that were really split. And then I had a lot of interests in like time and phenomenology and how you take a listener sort of through a piece. Well, finally, when I had my first sabbatical, which was like 2007 or 8, super late, I found the works of the French spectralists, so Murat and Grisé, and I like, I cannot believe this. This mm-hmm. is all of mm-hmm. my interests pulled together. This is everything I've been thinking toward and working toward, and it also, like, it lets me go back to electronic music, mm-hmm. my first love, which I really understand, and sort of step out of all the restrictions I was putting on myself in chamber music, which is my other passion. So I developed this way of working that is in all of the untitled pieces, where I take very often my own music and I put it into a DAW and I distort it and change it because, well, some of the underlying ideas are like, it's my past, so it's a memory. So it's like an echo in time, you know, of somebody that I was before and am not today. So I take it and I sort of process it in these metaphorical ways of like, echo is distance or, you know, reverb is memory. Until it doesn't resemble the original thing anymore. And I make this electronic sort of sonic model out of those materials. And I do it in a lot of different ways now, a lot of different ways. But the first one that I did, Untitled One, was really just an entire piece and that I just distorted and made into this other piece. So I take that sonic model and then I compose / transcribe it for chamber musicians to play. So it's this sort of interpretation of the instrumental synthesis that the spectralists were doing in the 70s and the 80s. Only I have these modern tools and I have also this trained ability that I can listen to something electronic and make it into something for chamber. Mm-hmm. You know? So I completely now work with frequency translated to pitch so people can read it. With the sound, the result is this very unusual, I think very beautiful, very sort of acoustically based music. It doesn't sound to me like anything else. And so Untitled 5 took parts of an earlier percussion solo and did this kind of distortion, and that's what I ended up with, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I really love it. It's very, you would never relate it to the piece that it came from. A composer named Philippe Jorel, which I think a lot of your listeners may recognize, mm-hmm. his works, at least his earlier works, he used to believe that they should relate to each other, like one should be the outgrowth of the one before it. So you could sort of trace right. what he was doing. I think that's absolutely true of the untitled pieces. And yeah, so now like sort of borrowing from myself and reinterpreting with this new technique, these new tools. So I've given you some like little excerpts of sonic models of these, right. like these little sort of beginnings, and then they can be compared, you know, to the piece as it actually came out. So I think maybe one that you have is Untitled 7.
Right. That's for the Untitled Six, which we are going to premiere in October. Was written for the camp artist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so the some of the sounds, so these are sort of co-written at the same times, because it was written for a group called Accentia in Basel, Switzerland, and they are also saxophone, piano, and percussion. Mm-hmm. And so, but they had their premiere already. So I had the finished version of that piece. Mm-hmm. And that piece, it's kind of an inside joke, and I don't usually go too much into the backstory of these pieces because they're kind of personal, but it's a joke, you know, the more cowbell joke with Christopher Walken from Saturday Night Live. I don't know, do you know this skit?
No, I don't.
If you don't know this, all of your listeners need to go ahead and Google SNL, go to YouTube, SNL More Cowbell, and just watch this thing. It is hilarious.
Okay, so, well, we're gonna include the link in the show notes.
that's good. So anyway, this piece, Untitled Seven, is just it's cowbell samples. Mm-hmm. And then I analyzed them spectrally and looked at their frequencies. And then I sort of, distorted them. So the whole piece goes from like a really dry cowbell sound up to at the end, like this big, whoosh, this sort of wash of noise. So, but along the way, there are these wonderful harmonics and multiphonics. And that became the basis for the piece that I wrote for you guys.
Yeah, very exciting. Well, I think we can listen to the Untitled Seven, and or should we hear the sample for Untitled Six first, and then we listen to the Untitled Seven, the whole piece? What do you recommend?
I think if you want to, I can talk a little bit about Untitled Six and those sounds.
Sure.
And I think it might be interesting to play. Like, I have just, I think, a minute of the sonic model. So that might be interesting to play just the opening, the electronic version, and then how the acoustic version came out. But I'm also happy to talk about Untitled Six, which is the new one.
Yeah, great. So let's hear the sonic model of Untitled Seven, and then we right after that we will listen to the whole piece, and then we'll come back. Okay, great. So now it's the Untitled Six.
Yes, which was written for you.
Yes.
And thinking about you very, very much. And, you know, whenever I compose a piece, it's not just notes that I'm thinking of. I'm mm-hmm. thinking of the actual people who are mm-hmm. going to be playing the piece, and also their personalities and the things that they like. And fortunately for me, I went to Campground 22, which I'm just going to reiterate was one of the best conferences I have ever been to. And especially in the US, I mean, we don't hear that kind of music very often and at that caliber of performance. So I knew Kevin, you know, I knew, Catherine and you. And so as I'm writing the piece, I'm able to see you in my mind and think about you playing. And so just to let you know, the piano part in this piece is very delicate, because I know that you mentioned that feels like your authentic self. And then I heard you play a duo concert.
Right.
I think you played Finnissy or something.
Right, yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, she's a monster. and so it's delicate, but it's really virtuosic too. So yeah, that's when I'm creating, I feel very intimately close to who I'm creating for. Even if I don't know who's going to play it, I just sort of imagine a person. But in this case, it's I feel very close to you, even though we have yet to really work together, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's a little insight. So with this particular piece, I chose these very sort of delicate relationships. And I found this online. It hadn't even been published in the paper form yet, but it was on YouTube, this video of a vibraphone multiphonic that Michael Egerton and Olaf Schappe, I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce his name, but Egerton is a composer and Schappe is a percussionist, and they found this multiphonic that was quite unusual on the vibraphone. So if you press the key in the first octave of the vibraphone, you press the key at about 30%, and then you strike it hard at the center, but toward the side of the key, toward the edge of the middle of the key. It produces this sort of unusual microtone above it. I think it's like a ninth, and I can't think of the other, because they actually change which ones, but they're super loud and they are not the octave and they're super exciting. So I downloaded all of these and I analyzed them to figure out what the multiphonic was. And then I took the loudest harmonic and I used that loudest harmonic to become the fundamental for a saxophone multiphonic.
Mm.
And so the whole piece is generated through this cycle. And then the saxophone multiphonic, again, I analyzed all of those and took the loudest harmonic from those, and that becomes the fundamental for the next vibraphone multiphonic. And then the piano part has this other multiphonic, which produces, especially the way I have it, is you press the string super hard, and then you press the key hard, and you don't hear the note of the key. You don't hear the fundamental. Right. But what you hear is the fifth and the seventh partial, which I think is a major third and this funky flat seven.
Yeah.
So I analyzed all of that too. And so every part of this piece is sort of a counterpoint between harmonics. So it doesn't have melody or, you know, rhythm meter in this sense, but it goes from being these unisons and these very clear harmonics that are sort of overlapping to generate the next thing, to further and further distances away, like more complex relationships. And the vibraphone and the piano also fill in some of the other harmonics. And it just becomes more and more complex as it goes. So, but it's very exciting to me because you can hear these things. Like, it just sounds so cool of one thing morphing into the next. And even if you're not listening hard for those overtones, it sounds good. Like it sounds like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And you may not even realize it's because certain things are matching up, you know, mm-hmm. in these sounds. Oh, and there's a gong. Cool. There's a gong where if you use like a Super Bowl mallet and you rub the gong, it creates this wash, you know, of sound. And all of those complex overtones, sometimes I use those to kind of blend the transition, you know, from one thing to the next. Anyway, it's super beautiful, I think. I'm excited. You know, it's my most recent work, and I think it's my best work so far. And
oh, that's always a great feeling.
Yeah. So I have these examples of one of the vibraphone multiphonics, and that sounds like this. And I have an example of one of the saxophone multiphonics, and the saxophone multiphonics all come from Untitled 7, which you just heard. So they're the actual multiphonics from that recording that I used in order to analyze to make the sonic model for the new piece. So that sounds like this. And then, so I took all of those things and I put them together. And actually, the piano multiphonic I don't have in the first part of this sonic model, but this was created so that I could hear sort of the sound of one thing, you know, going to the next thing. And I don't have the piano multiphonic because my son was recording it all for me. So this was like a slightly earlier version, but I have like about a minute of this sonic model at the beginning of Untitled 6.
Okay, yeah, and if you want to hear the piece in person, we have premiere concert October 7th at the University of South Florida in the USF Concert Hall. So you can meet Dorothy in person and all the other musicians and other composers as well. So, yeah. What you mentioned a little bit about, you know, that how you relate to the person when you compose music, who's going to play and who influenced you. And I felt that kind of communication from your artistic statement and you know, your music, that it's so important for you to have this kind of communication and all this relationship between the music and the society.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting because, you know, the last 4 years has been a really different kind of society, right? And the shift has been somewhat gradual, but persistent. And so prior to that time, I had written a lot of pieces. Pretty much everything I write has some kind of autobiographical aspect to it. But for a long time, I was expressing my thoughts about outward events. So like the history of Miami or the history of Birmingham, where I lived and taught for many years. And sort of, you know, like the things, like I wrote a piece about Sloss furnaces in Birmingham, which I would drive by every day and wonder about what is that thing. Mm-hmm. So I did some research into the history and I wrote a piece about it. As things like got more intense, I got really caught up in, so I am a left-leaning liberal, and so maybe people will turn off when they hear that. For a long time, I was composing with the news on, and it really perturbed me, disturbed me deeply that the news cycle is set up in such a way that they report a story and then they say sensationalize it, and like mm-hmm. let's say if there's a protest, so this is something called the protest paradigm, and it's sort of this formula where they begin showing like riots and turning it into sort of like circuses, and so the reason for the riot gets buried underneath the riot itself and the whatever, and also clearly we're talking about some of the horrible murders of people that happened in the 2000s. And so then the victim, they go into the background and sort of vilify the victim and dehumanize them. And there's also the when the news pulls in experts, they look very hard to have two different points of view, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the point of view of one of the experts is equally believed in and supported by the public, right? But they get this platform. And so anyway, there's just this whole thing, and you can look up protest paradigm and see how it goes, but it deeply disturbed me. And I thought, you know, my God. And then after, you know, however long, the story dies, right? And then it comes back. So during that time, I heard a story by Nadege Green on our local public radio station. And she was talking about these T-shirts that were made, these memorial T-shirts with the faces of murdered, specifically Black men. And she was talking about this business that sold these T-shirts. And I thought, my God, how can you have a whole business that's just supported by selling these T-shirts in this one neighborhood in my hometown, you know? So I was in this period in the 2000s, I was looking for things like a T-shirt, like an object that I could somehow sonify and sort of bring the stories back in front of the public eye. And when I say the public eye, I mean the new music audience, right? Because my music is not like out there. So anyway, I had these very, very strong expressions of my thoughts, my political thoughts about these social issues. And there were conversations around them. There were meant to be conversations around these things. I was trying to get things back in people's minds in a way other than like a news story would do it, you know, really sort of bring people back around to thinking about what had happened and the impact of it by simply sonifying a thing, right? But one conversation that I had really opened my eyes to the fact that this is also, it doesn't always, for the audience, focus on the thing. A lot of times it focuses back on the tragedy, and that can be seen as very exploitative, right? Like I am using somebody's misfortune to profit. And that is the last thing you know, that I wanted to do. I remember with 9/11 feeling like I can't write about this, you know? And so that conversation really made me realize, wow, I can't write about this stuff either, not in good conscience. So I went back and sort of looked at myself and started asking myself these questions. Well, you know, who am I? Like, what is my identity? What is my personal story? Not the story about the things around me or the things that I have opinions about that I want to share, but my own background and my own story. And there's a lot there to unpack. But I decided to do it under the title of Untitled. So in this way, I'm also not like, it's kind of a 180 degree reaction against what I was doing in the 2000s, which I thought was positive, but which was also damaging in ways that I had not seen. You know, I have these blind spots. And so, yeah, it sort of made me take stock of, okay, what, just because you have had, say, economic challenges, let's say, right, does not mean that you have experienced economic challenges in the way that a person of color would. So I'm a white woman, and you can't really see that, right? But I'm also a woman, so I have those kinds of issues. I have in my background mental health issues and homelessness issues and, you know, a lot of different economic issues, food insecurity, things like that, that are plenty of things for me to think about in my own music. And so the way it manifests in the Untitled series is as self-reflection through reinterpretation of those earlier works. And I came up with this series of questions that I needed to answer for myself in order to come to terms with my own past and try to explore my identity as maybe as other people saw it. And so these are the questions which drove the first work in the series, which is Untitled One. The questions are, can we erase the past, or can we atone for the mistakes we've made in the past? Can we see ourselves the way that other people see us? And how do we reconcile who we were with who we are today and the things we've learned? You know, so sort of how do we move forward when we confront the past in our presence? Because, you know, we carry our past in ourselves. It is who we are, but other people don't see that. They don't sort of know what we've been through. They can only assume who we are based on who they see today. And as I mentioned before, I am a white woman. I have a certain level of power and privilege that I did not necessarily grow up with. And so exploring my identity today was really, really important to me. And I have done a lot of reading and again, decided with this series to turn inward. So I'm not necessarily telling people, I'll tell people those questions, but I won't say specifically what piece I drew on to make the new piece. But I will tell you this about Untitled One. So what I did is I took an entire piece and I digitally processed it and transformed it, in particular using reverb to metaphorically capture this idea of distance that I mentioned before. And then I superposed this original recording on top of this new distorted version with this idea that phase cancellation would erase any part of the original. And then I transcribed what was left over to create this new piece. And I think of that new piece as sort of this musical shadow or this musical representation of that past that I carry with me that defines who I am, but that other people don't see. So that was the beginning, you know, of this series. I sent you the sonic model of the opening and the full version. I don't know if you want to play that piece, but that gives you a lot of sort of intro to that piece. So to answer a question that you asked earlier, you know, what do I want to communicate in these pieces? Well, I think there are things that really are personal that I want to explore myself and communicate to myself. You know, we all know that music can be whatever the listener wants it to be. And I think composers struggle with program notes and this idea of how much or how little do we tell somebody. Like, for example, Hector Berlioz has that super famous symphony fantastique that has a real story behind every single movement. And he published the program notes, but then after a while he withdrew the program notes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but who could listen to Symphony Fantastique without the program notes? Mm-hmm. But I think Untitled is really different. They're very abstract. And so even if I said, oh, this is about X, Y, and Z, I don't think people will hear that in these pieces. So in a way, they're my most personal messages, but they're also my most guarded. So it's strange, isn't it? You know my earlier works and the way I thought about having to tell something in the works. And now I'm having to withhold something in a way.
Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating. Gave me a lot to think about as a performing artist and as somebody who deals with music also. So yeah, it's so fascinating, really. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and insights.
Oh, it's totally my pleasure. Sort of to wrap up this follow-up with what you just said, if I can leave you with anything, something I embraced early on in my composing career is the idea that the performer reinterprets or interprets this thing that I wrote. So I get it as close to my imagination as I can, and then I offer it up. And very often performers will bring something to the piece that I never even considered, you know, and I love that so much. I'm thrilled that the music is open to that kind of interpretation beyond my own imagination. And so I think maybe the Untitled series is a good set of pieces for people to not feel like, oh, I have to tell this composer's story. Maybe it's I can tell my own story.
Yeah, it is. It's had so many layers, the piece, and it's music. It's a living thing. It just changes from person to person and time to time. And yeah, maybe that's why we do it. It's really,
yes,
yeah, amazing. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. I think it will be really nice to wrap up with a little bit of Untitled One. I don't think we have time to listen to the whole thing, but of course our listeners can, if they are interested in rest of the piece, go to your website, or you can they can email you and listen to the whole thing, right?
So yeah, and it's all up on YouTube as well.
Yeah. So we'll listen to the sonic model of Untitled One and then opening of Untitled. Yeah. Okay, great.
Great.
Thank you so much again for talking to me and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you. It's a real privilege for me. I really appreciate it.
I am excited to announce that as our podcast episodes will continue to deal with diverse topics and give you different insights, we have decided to put all our episodes into one category. So beginning next week, please make sure you subscribe to Camp Podcasts. And you can listen to all the episodes from Lost Time to Piano Talk, Play the Ink, and all beyond. Support us by donating. You can go to our website, www.contemporaryartmusicproject.org, and simply click the donate button. Help us continue our podcast, festival, and other exciting projects. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next time with more music.